Chapter 16. Service in an altogether green state. It was no use telling him that my mysterious vocation was so strong that my very wild oats had to be sown at sea. It was the exact truth, but he would not have understood the somewhat exceptional psychology of my seagoing, I fear. I suppose you've never come across one of your countrymen at sea. Have you, now? I admitted I never had. The examiner had given himself up to the spirit of gossiping idleness. For myself, I was in no haste to leave that room. Not in the least. The era of examinations was over. I would never again see that friendly man who was a professional ancestor, a sort of grandfather in the craft. Moreover, I had to wait till he dismissed me, and of that there was no sign. As he remained silent, looking at me, I added, "But I have heard of one, some years ago. He seems to have been a boy serving his time on board a Liverpool ship, if I am not mistaken. What was his name?" I told him. "How did you say that?" he asked, puckering up his eyes at the uncouth sound. I repeated the name very distinctly. "How do you spell it?" I told him. He moved his head at the impracticable nature of that name, and observed, "It's quite as long as your own, isn't it?" There was no hurry. I had passed for master, and I had all the rest of my life before me to make the best of it. That seemed a long time. I went leisurely through a small mental calculation, and said, "Not quite. Shorter by 2 letters, sir." "Is it?" The examiner pushed the signed blue slip across the table to me, and rose from his chair. Somehow this seemed a very abrupt ending of our relations, and I felt almost sorry to part from that excellent man, who was master of a ship before the whisper of the sea had reached my cradle. He offered me his hand, and wished me well. He even made a few steps toward the door with me, and ended with good-natured advice. "I don't know what may be your plans, but you ought to go into steam. When a man has got his master's certificate, it's the proper time. If I were you, I would go into steam." I thanked him, and shut the door behind me definitely on the era of examinations. But that time I did not walk on air, as on the first 2 occasions. I walked across the hill of many beheadings with measured steps. It was a fact, I said to myself, that I was now a British master mariner beyond a doubt. It was not that I had an exaggerated sense of that very modest achievement, with which, however, luck, opportunity, or any extraneous influence could have had nothing to do. That fact, satisfactory and obscure in itself, had for me a certain ideal significance. It was an answer to certain outspoken skepticism, and even to some not very kind aspersions. I had vindicated myself from what had been cried upon as a stupid obstinacy or a fantastic caprice. I don't mean to say that a whole country had been convulsed by my desire to go to sea. But for a boy between 15 and 16, sensitive enough, in all conscience, the commotion of his little world had seemed a very considerable thing indeed. So considerable that, absurdly enough, the echoes of it linger to this day. I catch myself in hours of solitude and retrospect meeting arguments, and charges made 35 years ago by voices now forever still, finding things to say that an assailed boy could not have found, simply because of the mysteriousness of his impulses to himself. I understood no more than the people who called upon me to explain myself. There was no precedent. I verily believe mine was the only case of a boy of my nationality and antecedents taking a, so to speak, standing jump out of his racial surroundings and associations. For you must understand that there was no idea of any sort of arrear in my call. Of Russia or Germany there could be no question. The nationality, the antecedents, made it impossible. The feeling against the Austrian service was not so strong, and I dare say there would have been no difficulty in finding my way into the naval school at Pola. It would have meant 6 months extra grinding at German, perhaps, but I was not past the age of admission, and in other respects I was well qualified. This expedient to palliate my folly was thought of, but not by me. I must admit that in that respect my negative was accepted at once. That order of feeling was comprehensible enough to the most inimical of my critics. I was not called upon to offer explanations, but the truth is that what I had in view was not a naval career, but the sea. There seemed no way open to it but through France. I had the language, at any rate, and of all the countries in Europe it is with France that Poland has most connection. There were some facilities for having me a little looked after, at first. Letters were being written, answers were being received, arrangements were being made for my departure for Marseille, where an excellent fellow called Solary got it in a roundabout fashion through various French channels, had promised good-naturedly to put Lejeune Homme in the way of getting a decent ship for his first start, if he really wanted a taste of sea meteor de Chine. I watched all these preparations gratefully, and kept my own counsel. But what I told the last of my examiners was perfectly true. Already the determined resolve, that F.A. Seaman, then an English seaman, was formulated in my head, though, of course, in the Polish language. I did not know six words of English, and I was astute enough to understand that it was much better, to say nothing of my purpose. As it was, I was already looked upon as partly insane, at least by the more distant acquaintances. The principal thing was to get away. I put my trust in the good-natured Solary's very civil letter to my uncle, though I was shocked a little by the phrase about the meteor de Chine. This Solary Baptistin, when I beheld him in the flesh, turned out a quite young man, very good-looking, with a fine black, short beard, a fresh complexion, and soft merry black eyes. He was as jovial and good-natured as any boy could desire. I was still asleep in my room in a modest hotel near the quays of the Old Port, after the fatigues of the journey via Vienna, Zurich, Lyons, when he burst in, flinging the shutters open to the sun of Provence and chiding me boisterously for lying abed. How pleasantly he startled me by his noisy objurgations, to be up and off instantly for a 3 years campaign in the South Seas. Oh, magic words! Ni campen de Trois and stands les mers du Sud, that is the French for a 3 years deep water voyage. He gave me a delightful waking, and his friendliness was unwearied. But I fear he did not enter upon the quest for a ship for me in a very solemn spirit. He had been at sea himself, but had left off at the age of 25, finding he could earn his living on shore in a much more agreeable manner. He was related to an incredible number of Marseille well-to-do families of a certain class. One of his uncles was a shipbroker of good standing, with a large connection among English ships. Other relatives of his dealt in ships' stores, owned sail lofts, sold chains and anchors, were master stevedores, caulkers, shipwrights. His grandfather, I think, was a dignitary of a kind, the syndic of the pilots. I made acquaintances among these people, but mainly among the pilots. The very first whole day I ever spent on salt water was by invitation, in a big half-decked pilot boat, cruising under close reefs on the lookout, in misty, blowing weather, for the sails of ships and the smoke of steamers rising out there, beyond the slim and tall planier lighthouse cutting the line of the wind-swept horizon with a white perpendicular stroke. They were hospitable souls, these sturdy Provençal seamen. Under the general designation of Le Petit, Ami de Baptistin, I was made the guest of the Corporation of Pilots, and had the freedom of their boats night or day. And many a day and a night too, did I spend cruising with these rough, kindly men, under whose auspices my intimacy with the sea began. Many a time the little friend of Baptistin had the hooded cloak of the Mediterranean sailor thrown over him by their honest hands, while dodging at night under the lee of Chateau d'Aft on the watch for the lights of ships. Their sea-tanned faces, whiskered or shaved, lean or full, with the intent, wrinkled sea eyes of the pilot breed, and here and there a thin gold hoop at the lobe of a hairy ear, bent over my sea infancy. The first operation of seamanship I had an opportunity of observing was the boarding of ships at sea, at all times, in all states of the weather. They gave it to me to the full. And I have been invited to sit in more than one tall, dark house of the old town at their hospitable board, at the bow ill base ladled out into a thick plate by their high-voiced, broad-browed wives, talk to their daughters thick-set girls, with pure profiles, glorious masses of black hair arranged with complicated art, dark eyes, and dazzlingly white teeth. I had also other acquaintances of quite a different sort. One of them, Madame Delestang, an imperious, handsome lady in a statuesque style, would carry me off now and then on the front seat of her carriage to the Prado, at the hour of fashionable airing. She belonged to one of the old aristocratic families in the South. In her haughty weariness she used to make me think of Lady Dedlock in Dickens' Bleak House, a work of the master for which I have such an admiration, or rather such an intense and unreasoning affection, dating from the days of my childhood, that its very weaknesses are more precious to me than the strength of other men's work. I have read it innumerable times, both in Polish and in English. I have read it only the other day, and, by a not very surprising inversion, the Lady Dedlock of the book reminded me strongly of the L. Madame Delestang. Her husband, as I sat facing them both, with his thin, bony nose and a perfectly bloodless, narrow physiognomy clamped together, as it were, by short, formal side whiskers, had nothing of Sir Leicester Dedlock's grand air and courtly solemnity. He belonged to the haute bourgeoisie only, and was a banker, with whom a modest credit had been opened for my needs. He was such an ardent no, such a frozen-up, mummified royalist that he used in current conversation terms of speech contemporary, I should say, with the good Henry Quater, and when talking of money matters, reckoned not in francs, like the common godless herd of post-revolutionary Frenchmen, but in obsolete and forgotten ecosecus of all money units in the world. As though Louis Quaters were still promenading in royal splendor the gardens of Versailles, and Monsieur de Colbert busy with the direction of maritime affairs. You must admit that in a banker of the 19th century it was a quaint idiosyncrasy. Luckily, in the counting house it occupied part of the ground floor of the Delestang town residence. In a silent, shady street, the accounts were kept in modern money, so that I never had any difficulty in making my wants known to the grave, low-voiced, decorous, legitimist, I suppose, clerks, sitting in the perpetual gloom of heavily barred windows behind the somber, ancient counters, beneath lofty ceilings with heavily molded cornices. I always felt, on going out, as though I had been in the temple of some very dignified, but completely temporal religion. And it was generally on these occasions, that under the great carriage gateway Lady Dead, I mean Madame Delestang, catching sight of my raised hat, would beckon me with an amiable imperiousness to the side of the carriage, and suggest with an air of amused nonchalance, Venice donc faire un tour avec nous. To which the husband would add an encouraging Est circa Allens, Montes, June Homme. He questioned me sometimes, significantly but with perfect tact and delicacy, as to the way I employed my time, and never failed to express the hope that I wrote regularly to my honored uncle. I made no secret of the way I employed my time, and I rather fancy that my artless tales of the pilots, and so on entertained Madame Delestang so far as that ineffable woman could be entertained by the prattle of a youngster very full of his new experience among strange men and strange sensations. She expressed no opinions, and talked to me very little, yet her portrait hangs in the gallery of my intimate memories, fixed there by a short and fleeting episode. One day, after putting me down at the corner of a street, she offered me her hand, and detained me, by a slight pressure, for a moment. While the husband sat motionless and looking straight before him, she leaned forward in the carriage to say, with just a shade of warning in her leisurely tone, colon ill fought, suppendant, fair attention a ne pas gaiter savai. I had never seen her face so close to mine before. She made my heart beat and caused me to remain thoughtful for a whole evening. Certainly one must, after all, take care not to spoil one's life. But she did not know, nobody could know how impossible that danger seemed to me. Why can the transports of first love be calmed, checked, turned to a cold suspicion of the future by a grave quotation from a work on political economy? I ask, is it conceivable? Is it possible? Would it be right? With my feet on the very shores of the sea, and about to embrace my blue-eyed dream, what could a good-natured warning as to spoiling one's life mean to my youthful passion? It was the most unexpected, and the last too, of the many warnings I had received. It sounded to me very bizarre, and, uttered as it was in the very presence of my enchantress, like the voice of folly, the voice of ignorance. But I was not so callous or so stupid as not to recognize there also the voice of kindness. And then the vagueness of the warning, because what can be the meaning of the phrase? To spoil one's life? Arrested one's attention by its air of wise profundity. At any rate, as I have said before, the words of La Belle Madame Delestang made me thoughtful for a whole evening. I tried to understand, and tried in vain, not having any notion of life as an enterprise that could be managed. But I left off being thoughtful shortly before midnight, at which hour, haunted by no ghosts of the past, and by no visions of the future, I walked down the quay of the viewport, to join the pilot boat of my friends. I knew where she would be waiting for her crew, in the little bit of a canal behind the fort at the entrance of the harbor. The deserted quays looked very white and dry in the moonlight, and as if frostbound in the sharp air of that December night. A prowler or two slunk by noiselessly, a custom house guard, soldier-like, a sword by his side, paced close under the bowsprits of the long row of ships moored bows on opposite the long, slightly curved, continuous flat wall of the tall houses that seemed to be one immense abandoned building with innumerable windows shuttered closely. Only here and there a small, dingy cafe for sailors cast a yellow gleam on the bluish sheen of the flagstones. Passing by, one heard a deep murmur of voices inside, nothing more. How quiet everything was at the end of the quays on the last night on which I went out for a service cruise as a guest of the Marseille pilots. Not a footstep, except my own, not a sigh, not a whispering echo of the usual revelry going on in the narrow unspeakable lanes of the old town, reached my ear, and suddenly, with a terrific jingling rattle of iron and glass, the omnibus of the Joliet on its last journey swung around the corner of the dead wall which faces across the paved road the characteristic angular mass of the Fort St. John. Three horses trotted abreast, with the clatter of hoofs on the granite setts, and the yellow, uproarious machine jolted violently behind them, fantastic, lighted up, perfectly empty, and with the driver apparently asleep on his swaying perch above that amazing racket. I flattened myself against the wall and gasped. It was a stunning experience. Then after staggering on a few paces in the shadow of the fort, casting a darkness more intense than that of a clouded night upon the canal, I saw the tiny light of a lantern standing on the quay, and became aware of muffled figures making toward it from various directions. Pilots of the third company hastening to embark. Too sleepy to be talkative, they step on board in silence. But a few low grunts and an enormous yawn are heard. Somebody even ejaculates colon ah. Cockwin de sort. And sighs wearily at his hard fate. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.